number.
Now, which gun was responsible for that?
That was the 9.2 inch. That, that put in a big shell, 340 pound weight, and so it was a powerful piece of explosive, and it was there to sink any ships that were coming in with the intention of blocking, whereas the 6 inch were to engage ships like a destroyer might be doing, carrying out spoiling tactics. Counter bombardment goes back to the history of Hartlepool. In 1914, you had these three battle cruisers that bombarded Scarborough and Hartlepool. The engagement of counter bombardment is engaging at long range, and therefore you have to have the facilities for seeing shooting at. Now, by the time it was decided before the war that the counter bombardment capability had to be upgraded on the East Coast, there was the fear that Hull might be bombarded by battleships that were sailing on the coast, and so the intention was to put in 6-inch Mark 24 guns at Aldbrough, Aldbrough, and also at Hartlepool. The Hartlepool guns were installed. I believe the Aldbrough gun. They did get as far as proofing mounting, but the guns that were intended to be installed at Aldbrough were shipped to New Zealand for the defences of New Zealand against the Japanese, but the ship was sunk on the way, I believe. The three 6-inch Mark 24s were established at Hartlepool. The tower, the observation tower that was to control them, which was to be built in the old Coast Guard barracks further up the coast, was never done, and so the visual control for the counter-bombardment role was never installed. The part I played in it was to install the guns, and we also controlled the quite elaborate fire control required for a counter-bombardment, to control the fire of a gun. The target that cannot be seen from the battery does require a fair amount of control gear, and there was a thing called a fire direction table, known originally as the naval table, because it is part of the control gear that you find in a warship, typically in a cruiser. You'll find the fire direction table.
And how did that all work, the whole
control? The fire direction table in full flood was mainly electric or electromagnetic in operation, and that the information coming into it from various sources, you would be able to plot the position of the target ship and also work out the bearing and range to the target ship from that. The fire direction table Mark 4, was it? Might Mark 5 that we installed at Hartlepool. A lot of the magnetic devices were replaced by men who had to measure on the table the continually changing range and bearing to the targets, so that they plotted and worked out the instructions for the gun. But on the naval table,
using binoculars or what?
Well, no, you couldn't see. I mean, this was underground. This was in the concrete. We installed the concrete place for the fire direction table in a corner. One of the things that we did in Hartlepool on mobilisation was to requisition the Hartlepool Rovers football ground, and one of the things that we would have disappointed the Rovers was, we not only did we put the huts for our soldiery on it, but also we put this substantial concrete underground control room on it as well. I suspect the Hartlepool Rovers probably resited their football ground after the war.
Now, what? Where did the information come from? Do you see what I mean? Guided this.
I did explain to you that this installation was never completed. It should have come from a tower that was never built. There was further up the coast an old Coast Guard unit in the earlier days, the coast guards were in this walled enclosure, no doubt maintaining control of the coastline, so the counter bombardment, as I say, at battery on the at Hull was never in fact installed. The one in Hartlepool, the guns were, but the fire control that went into it was only partially completed. It was never really fully effective.
So, what I mean is, I understand it wasn't, but I mean, I can't see how it worked at all.
Ah, well, from the tower, one would have observed the target. The tower was, say, I don't know, a mile away from the guns, and therefore the information from that observation would have been transmitted to the fire direction table, and the fire direction table would have worked out what the bearing and range from the guns were. And in a full counter-bombardment installation, there would, of course, have been more than one place. And as I was saying, in the 1920 time, there were these other observations in the village of Hart and the observation post in the hotel at Redcar that would have been feeding the information that would have been required for the batteries at Pasley, which was the one which I knew, and the one which got engulfed in the chemical works, which was called Pallister.
This never really happened, so I mean
the installation in Hartlepool was cancelled before it was fully completed. So we got the guns
and the underground chamber, but
and the underground for the fire direction table was there, and we also installed underground electrical generating equipment for again the fire control purposes, which was not ever fully operational. When I left Hartlepool to go to the war gunnery course, that was the stage that it was at.
Now, what about the mess, the officers' mess? What was that like? What was the overall atmosphere, and what was a typical night like in the mess?
The pre-war war department buildings were the contained the guns and everything to do with the guns and the ammunition and the magazines, the underground magazines and the lighthouse and so on. The officers' mess was in civilian houses that were requisitioned at the end of the streets, they were domestic housing. I lived in one room of one house. The one next door to it was the officers' mess, the various rooms in the house had been used for anteroom and dining room. I suppose the main memory I have of that was when there was a prince who died. His airplane crashed on his way, was it to Iceland? I remember that he stayed with us in Hartlepool, and I can remember him eating in the mess. The mess room, there were two tables and he was on one of them, and I remember in the conversation Walter Todd asking him whether he had ever been to Woolworths, and he had. Duke of Kent, I think, signed the visitor's book as George, I remember, to my surprise.
Now, what would a mess occasion like that be like from start to finish?
Well, it was completely informal. There was no formal proceedings. There was a time when the meal was ready. The mess servants would tell us that the meal was ready. We would go in and sit down and eat it. It was a simple, remember, we are talking about wartime and we're talking about simple recipes, and there was no great formality about it. The anteroom was the room in the house that faced the sea, and so you could see what was going on, and the Jane's fighting ships was always there and available for reference. I can remember an unfortunate mistake I made once with Walter when he asked for Jane, implying Jane's fighting ships, and I passed him the Daily Mirror for the strip cartoon of the same name, which was quite unconscious as far as I was concerned, but caused a laugh at the time. No.
Was it a hard drinking mess? You know what I mean? No, some messes drunk, some don't.
Not in my time. I believe my successor made a fool of himself with drink, but in my time there was no. I had probably a glass of sherry. In fact, I seem to recall that it was my habit, and it was, I think, one which I learnt from the much older subaltern who was my junior. We drank bamboos. I'm not quite sure what bamboos were now. There was also, I think sherry was probably the main drink before. There was not much drinking done. If I did any drinking, it was in town. I can remember that there was a bar in town that I used to go to. There was a good trolley bus service from Hartlepool. Hartlepool, in those days, of course, was very proud of itself being a separate borough, and West Hartlepool was regarded as a quite different place. Today, of course, it's all one place, the Hartlepools, but in those days, where the theatre was, and I occasionally went into the hotel in town, which always seemed to be in the mode of, because the air raid sirens have sounded, there is only the a la carte menu available, which was the air raid sirens had usually sounded, so the a la carte was the only menu available. The theatre I used to go to, and there was a dentist in town who the officers made use of, who was also very much in evidence at the theatre. I went, it was a music hall theatre, sort of the knockabout music hall stuff, and the exotic dancing and that, but no great high intellectual stimulation. I don't remember being involved much with the church. There is a very distinguished church in Hartlepool, St Hilda's, but I don't think I was a regular attender at its service. I think any worship was done through the military. The Bishop of Jarrow was the bishop who had the responsibility of liaising with the soldiery in the diocese, and I can remember him coming in to our mess. And indeed it was, I think, because of a visit of his that I and three other officers went to attend the service of Lessons and Carols at Durham Cathedral at Christmas time. I expect that would be Christmas 40. I'm sure it had to be Christmas 40.
How about, one thing we haven't mentioned was this new battery, and the key personnel in that you recall. We should have did that with B battery, but with A battery, with the Hough battery.
Well, the one that came down from Orkney.
Any figures that struck come to mind, either officers or...
Well, when the battery came down from Orkney, there was a man, lost his name, probably Hardy, who was from Ulster, and he was involved in... the making of handkerchiefs in Ulster, and I can remember I once almost came across him. After the war, I sailed in the Queen Mary to, and I found in conversation with the staff that there had been a very regular user of their ship who turned out to be the same Hardy who was well known to the staff of the Queen Mary, but I don't think I never actually saw him again.
What was he like, Captain Howard? Captain or Lieutenant?
He was a Lieutenant. He was the talkative Irishman, Ulsterman. I don't remember too much about him. There was one man who I did see quite a bit of, and his name was Powling, P-O-W-L-I-N-G. He was a man old enough to be my father, who was... very proud of his son, who was serving in the RAF at that time. I think Powling had some difficulty in finding himself subordinate to me, who was no doubt no older than his son. And I can remember Powling quite misguidedly taking advice from me. There had been a question of calibrating a sub-caliber machine gun on one of the 12-pounders so that they could practice, and he was wondering how you could calibrate it, and I pointed out that you calibrated it by using one of the buoys in the harbour, meaning, of course, that you would lay off the buoy to observe the forward shot of the machine gun bullets, so that you could calibrate the machine gun to match the sighting on the 12-pounder. He was not terribly bright, Powling, and he thought that I was in advising him to shoot at the buoy, which he succeeded in sinking instead of shooting alongside it. But that was Powling, yes. Hardy, yes. Who else do I remember in the mess? There was a man, Campion. He was... his job was in the Inland Revenue, I think in Darlington. He was quite a clever, able a subaltern of mine, and there was another subaltern called Brockhurst. He was an architect by skill, and therefore we were very adept at producing training sheets for the soldiers, producing large-scale drawings of the workings of artillery equipment, using the skills of the architect, and the civil servant from Inland Revenue was not to be outdone. So we produced a fair amount of training material. Brockhurst, he volunteered to join the Indian sappers. There was an application, there was an advertisement in the command orders asking for suitably qualified officers to volunteer to serve in the Indian Army, and I can remember regretting the loss of Brockhurst, who had decided that he should keep his engineer and architect skills more used than they were with the artillery, and he went off to India. He married an ATS officer before he did, and from Edinburgh, and I can remember that their baby was born after he had gone to India, and I can remember sending my good greetings to his wife, who I don't think I ever met. Campion, Brockhurst, yes, there was another man I can remember, Whittaker. I met him in Manchester after the war. He was another of the subalterns, no particular characteristics, I think.
Sounds a reasonable crowd of officers.
Yes, I never had any problems with them. The man who succeeded me, Williams, did I mention Williams?
No.
He was the man who succeeded me.
He was there at the time, though.
He was there at the time, yes. He was the senior subaltern when I left.
What was he like?
I can remember him physically, and I can't remember too much about him. I can remember that I was told after, when I inquired about the unit some while afterwards, got into some difficulty with drinking too much, but he was not doing that when he was under my hand.
And what about the warrant officers and senior NCOs? Any come to mind?
But the one I mainly remember was Ord.
I thought he was with the previous lot.
I'm sorry, he was not with. In that case, I've confused you. He was.
All right. So BSM Ord was actually with A battery.
He was with A battery, or 268 as it was by then. I
Well, we discussed him. Yeah. Nobody else particularly of the NCOs. Were they a good crowd of NCOs?
Yes, I was happy with them. And one of the things, there were things which surprised me. Twice I had been taken aback. In my very early days in France, before, when I was in the base camp at Guérande in Normandy, one of the soldiers, who was an inadequate lad, could not stand it and deserted, and of course was rapidly picked up by the military police and court-martialed. He embarrassed me by asking me to be his defending officer, which I was considerably... well, I was unexpected and found it difficult to deal with. Another of these things by the soldiery that surprised me was when I came to leave Yaffa Battery. I found that a collection had been taken up, and I was presented with a very large supply of expensive cigarettes and a cigarette case, which I still have somewhere, with my signature engraved on it, which had been copied off my Part 1 orders. I had not expected that the soldiers would take it upon themselves to mark my departure in this way. So I suppose...
You got on well with them, then?
I suspect that we liked each other. I had no... I can remember individuals. There was a man called Neil, whom I had a liking for and obviously had ability, but he was so prone to keep disappearing into Hartlepool to his lady friends when he was not supposed to, that I had great difficulty in keeping him at a higher rank than gunner. I remember too one of my soldiers having rather dubious sick notes provided by some civilian doctor when he was on leave. And it was explained to me by one of my more experienced clerks that in Wales, a doctor would sign anything that you put in front of them. So perhaps I was not. I was learning about the civilian world.
Were there any disciplinary problems with them at all?
Well, yes. So there was the usual problems of people who had outstayed. And people who hadn't done things, and people who had, nothing that warranted other action beyond mine.
It never went above you?
I don't think I ever had to send anyone to Walter Todd. It's possible I did, but I can't remember it.
So the main things were drunkenness, was that much of a problem?
No, I don't think we had much trouble with drunkenness. We had certainly trouble with people who... did not come back on time, and people who failed to do things they should have done.
Would they come? How long would they take off? AWOL. Was it just a day or so, or was it?
Yes, I would think a day or so. I don't think there was anything. I do remember I remember the court martials. I remember at this stage were of soldiers who were not in my unit. I remember. There was one which I served on as part of the court. It was of an Irishman who did not wish to be called up, and he was eventually arrested and sent because he should have turned up in the army. And of course, because he had succeeded in avoiding the call-up, he had no capability of turning left or turning right when so ordered by the sergeant in charge of the squad. He had been an Irishman who had come from Ireland, and whenever any attempt was made by the Ministry of Labour to giving up, calling out papers, he decamped to somewhere else, and eventually he was put in front of us. I can remember
was
that.
Was he a conscientious objector? Or was he
certainly not a conscientious objector. He was just a fly boy who was living off his wits and was no intention of being called up into the army. There was no conscientious capability. He was just a...
Now, what was your role on the court-martial and what do you remember of it?
Oh, my role was to hear the evidence and decide...
You were actually on the board?
Oh, yes, I was on the board. The evidence was mainly from civilian staff of the Labour Exchange who said they'd seen him and that they had given him the piece of paper and he hadn't done it, and so therefore he was in breach of... I can't now remember whether I was the president of the court, or I expect I was the president, I suppose. And I can remember this stuck in my memory as being an improbable event. I can remember one of the things the 15th Scottish Division did before, when they were training, was they rehearsed the role that they would have in seizing a coast artillery battery from the landward side, and they rehearsed this on the coast artillery units on the Tyne, and I was one of the officers who had to be engaged in the umpiring of this particular exercise. I remember it well.
What do you remember of that? Tell us, how did it all work?
The thing I particularly remember about it was that it prevented me from attending my cousin's wedding, because I had to attend the exercise, so I was cross about that. The exercise, it went as straightforwardly as exercises do. I was there to observe what was done in the Coast Artillery Unit in Tynemouth, and I think the only complication that happened was someone was instructed to put smoke equipment to prevent the telephone exchange from working in order to confuse the situation. And I can remember the confusion that this created and the annoyance for the artillery officers at having the telephone exchange out of action, because it was unusable for some time afterwards. It was an exercise. I remember it taking place. I don't remember any particular features of it.
Anything else before you went? You went on the course.
The gunnery staff course.
That would be in January 1943. From
that's
the
right. Course. That's when I left Hartlepool.
Now, anything else before you leave Hartlepool then? Any other recollections of...
There were a number of occasions on which senior officers came to inspect us in Hartlepool to see that we were doing what we should be doing. And I can remember one brigadier who came to inspect us, who arrived on his motorbike, and as he came through the guard, he just took off his crash helmet and put on his red hat so that he could carry out the inspection in full uniform. I cannot remember any great difficulty with inspecting officers, but I can remember that I was advised in my early days always to leave something that was not quite right at an early stage of the inspection, so that the inspecting officer could point out to you that this was not right, and they would then be at ease from then on, having found their one task, and I always found that worked quite well. The layout at Hartlepool was historically conditioned by the two Yuff guns and the lighthouse gun that had originally been separate units or separate fighting units. Each Mark II central pivot mounting had underground magazines to have the ammunition. You could still see that there had been elaborate devices so that you could have had lighting, which would of course not have been electric in those days. It would have been something burning in a hurricane lamp, and these were in shrouded in separate cages so that there would be no risk of setting light to the gunpowder or explosives charges that were in the there were lifts to bring the shell and the cartridges up to the gun platforms. Once there was, I found when I was inspecting on a very wet day, I was surprised to see that water was beginning to swell in one of the inspection manholes for the drains, and I can remember turning the battery out with buckets so that they could fill their buckets from the manhole and tipped the water into the sea, so it didn't go back into the drainage system, which was obviously not working correctly. So we avoided